Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Thank you for joining us. Today is Manhattan Project Monday, and we like to talk about the events of the aftermath, I guess, of the Manhattan Project. And today we have back on with us our guest, Matt Holstrunk, who is a citizen scientist, really, who basically got the fear of God put in him when Fukushima happened, got busy and began to really understand what was going on. So we only have an hour, so I'm going to introduce Matt right away. Matt, thank you for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here, Lonnie.
It's awesome. So why don't you explain a little bit how you got into this? Because as you said, you're a citizen scientist. What's your background and how do you, I mean, what Matt has been doing is taking RadNet information and graphing the Pacific Basin, correct?
Yes.
So how did you get into that, and how did you begin? Like, I have looked many times. It's hard, very difficult for me to comprehend this stuff. How did you get into this, and how long did it take you to get up to speed, and why don't you give us a synopsis of your current work?
Sure. So, you know, like most people, I listened to the news happening in 2011, heard about a big earthquake there, and the problems that they were having with the reactors. And based on the limited knowledge that I knew back then, I knew it was a very, very serious event, especially when they started having a very long time before they were able to get any sort of power back on to cool any of the reactors or the spent fuel pools over there. And so that really put a lot of fear into me, and the fear was based on not knowing, not really understanding what was going on. And so I decided I was going to spend some serious time to try to look at it and try to figure out what I'm hearing is truth or is it something else. And at that point, I had no idea about the RadNet system that we had. I had no idea we could get it, that the general public could get on and download data and look at that data in various ways. And what I've been doing is looking at that data on a spreadsheet, like an Excel spreadsheet, and then that has the ability to graph what the data points are, so you can have a quick visual look and understand if it's what's happening here. You can see the spikes, you can see the dips, you can see the areas where, well, you can't see the areas, but there are areas in the data where they don't even give you data.
Wow.
And so then you have to go back and manually put in on the spreadsheet those hours. You have to expand the graph and put those hours in, and then plug an estimated value of what you think is in there. And there's a lot of reasons why they could have data that they're not showing.
Valid reasons, or like reasons just from knowing what the information is?
Sure, there could be valid reasons. They might have a instrument failure. They might have battery failure. They might be updating software. They might be, there's a million different excuses mm-hmm. that they can give out. And those excuses are valid. I understand that, but when I see these kind of blackouts happening at critical times during 2011, and I see them happening in many different cities, it makes me wonder if maybe they're blacking it out for another reason.
Hmm.
And that reason would be the values were too high and they don't want anybody to see what those are. So there's no way for them to show it, so they just black it out and hope nobody asks the question.
Very few people do. Because we can't really... Chuck Heinemann and I were talking about this a couple weeks ago on the air. He has also been following, but he has a different venue. Like, his whole thing is about how we can reverse the radioactive contamination with microbes. So he's constantly going... Right. And he lives in Kansas, so I think you were on the air with him. So this is one of the biggest, hardest parts with lay people is that we just can't comprehend what we're reading. Like, they give us the information, but it's all mumbled, jumbled up, so you don't really... Like, it sounds like it's really scary, over 10,000 CPMs per minute.
Yeah, and it really depends. The whole scare on the counts per minute thing is a hard one to grasp, because everybody's detectors... Everybody has different sensitivities on their detectors. And so what you're detecting and what I'm detecting and what the EPA detecting, we can have our instruments right in a circle within 3 feet of each other, and all three of them will be giving different readings.
Right. We've seen
that
in many videos.
The EPAs will be actually giving the highest readings of just about any of them that we can put up against, because they use a fan to pull in air way faster. They use a filter that collects the particles, and it's way more sensitive to what they have than anything that we can come up with. It's probably a $10,000 instrument that they have, or more.
Wow.
And then they have to have computers, laptops to interface, and everything else. So it's a very expensive. And they have to have people to monitor it, to change out the filters from time to time. Otherwise, the filters just build up, and the radiation levels just get higher and higher and higher. So we can see on the graphs, we can see the change-out days that happen with the filters when the values go to its lowest point. That is a filter change-out day, and it always happens twice a week. And you can see 3 to 5 days, 3 days, 5 days, 3 days, 5 days. And or two days, 5 days, which it used to be, and they've changed it down to three and four, which is a little bit better.
So where are you studying specifically? You said the Pacific Basin, but where does that include, Matt?
Okay, that includes every RadNet station that I can access that is located in the states, in the U.S. states, bordering the Pacific Ocean. So I've got data from Hawaii, from Honolulu. I've got data from the three sites up in Alaska, which are Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage. I've got data in the state of Washington, all of the stations in Washington that give out data. I've got all the stations in Oregon. There's only two, basically Portland and Corvallis. I've got both stations in Idaho, that being Idaho Falls and Boise. And then I have all of the stations in California, all the way from San Diego all the way up to Eureka.
Wow. Did you say Hawaii also?
Hawaii, Honolulu, yep.
Wow. So give us an idea. I mean, what are radiation rates like? I mean, we've heard many things that the EPA has raised the allowable radiation limits. Do you know what those currently are?
Well, they've raised those limits in so many different things. I haven't had time to keep track of all
that.
They
have been doing that. That's true.
Yeah, I know. They've done it in water, and they've done it in food, and it's a lot to take in when you're trying to watch what they're doing these days. And I've been basically concentrating just on my graphical.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think the rates are? What are the rates around on the Pacific? I mean, is the Northwest more radioactive, say, than California and Hawaii? Is Idaho?
It's really hard to compare between cities unless they have geography, and basically geography is what it's all about. It's all about what latitude you're on. It's all about if you're in a valley or if you're on the coast or if you're
Well, explain what that means. Let's say you're in one family member's in a valley. Let's say
Willamette Valley.
Yeah. And then
let's choose the Willamette Valley. Perfect valley. You know, we have a valley in California.
By the way, to our listeners, I live in the Willamette Valley. So that's where Eugene, Oregon is the Willamette Valley. As opposed to what other mountain range, as opposed to a mountain range, say by Mount Hood or something like that up by Portland?
Right. Well, Portland's a little different. Let's talk about the valley. Let's talk about Willamette Valley first.
That's where
we are. That's where you are. I'm up in Corvallis, actually. And Corvallis, luckily, has a RadNet monitor here. And it's here for basically to watch over Oregon State's trigger reactor that they have up here.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, RadNet stations are put in place at reactor locations to monitor those reactors. Portland has one up at Reed College, and that's why that is there.
Portland has a trigger station at Reed College?
Yes, they do. Yep.
Wow, that's news to
yep.
me.
Yep, it's part of their nuclear engineering program. And basically, if they have a nuclear engineering program, they'll have a reactor. So that's how you tell. But then you look at RadNet and you see one there and you go, oh, that's the schools.
unless they
have a power reactor.
Okay.
Yeah, unless they have a power reactor.
So it's,
and then it's probably
near
positioned
reactor
to the power
or near the trigger stations.
Yes.
Interesting. Yep. Okay.
So anyway, in the Willamette Valley here, the primary thing we get here, we get a lot of stagnant air. So we'll have stuff coming in off the coast, and it'll peel up over the mountains, and it'll come in here and roll and just sort of stagnate and fall down at the on the base and just sort of hang there. You know that in the morning when you wake up and there's fog here.
Mm-hmm.
And like this time of year, a lot of morning fog.
Right.
And if you get up on a high mountain and look down, you can see it. It's just the whole valley is just this ocean
of a blanket of clouds.
Of white, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, a lot of these bad radionuclides that came off of Fukushima like to hang out in clouds. They are water soluble and they love being there. That's just their thing. And one of the bad ones is the cesium.
Hmm.
Very, very water soluble.
Hmm.
And it's a.
What are the radiation levels or the radioactive contamination levels in our area? What are they like? I mean, what's the range? Is it going down,
yeah,
or does it go up and down and up and down?
Well, basically, from what I've seen on the graphs, it started off at the highest points in 2011. In 2012, there was typically a drop, although a lot of them had even higher readings in 2012.
Hmm.
And then there's typically a big drop after the initial hit. But then it rebounds. It'll come back up and then go back down and come back up and come back down. And I'm talking years here in duration doing this up and down thing.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, so we've had 6 years, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I've seen this up and down thing. It's currently, depending on site, and it depends a lot on the site, some of them are going down, some of them are actually going up in levels. And so, you know, there are other factors here at play other than just Fukushima. There are other releases, other things going on that I have a hard time explaining to myself and explaining to anybody else. Why is it that 2015 has the highest levels at these cities? Well, I don't really know.
2015 has the highest levels since 2011. Is that what you're saying?
On some cities, yep.
Huh.
I can bring those up and talk about those if you want.
Well, I wonder. I wonder what
yes.
what relation that has to the activities of what was going on at Fukushima, because we know it's all generated. Like, this is the big issue. You know, last week some people were kind of irritated that I was discussing politics and the election, honestly, and right. not radiation. But for me, the social engineering, this is what fascinates me. It's the social engineering of getting people to ignore the fact that we are being radioactively contaminated now for 6 years almost. And it really took me by surprise. I mean, it definitely, when I woke up to this idea, and I did not until 2012, it hit me like a ton of bricks that all of us have been just kind of unconsciously trained to ignore it. Like,
yeah.
What's going on with the radioactive contamination right now? It's still coming from Fukushima, right? It's not like that's done. It's still spewing
no.
into the air, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's not done. It probably won't ever be done in our lifetime.
Do you think if there was like some big gigantic earthquake that would, like another tsunami type of thing, what would happen if there was like a big gigantic earthquake and a tsunami that affected those power plants? Would that actually bury the nuclear power plants and resolve the issue?
Well, if the site was inland, it might temporarily solve it, but it's not. It's located right on the edge of the ocean, and if that thing ever goes, anything that goes down from those plants are going to get in the ocean, in the Pacific Ocean. There's no way around it because they have an aquifer that actually flows right through that area.
And it actually probably is getting into it. That's really the issue, isn't it? So what are the, I'm really dying to, what are the levels of radiation coming here in Willamette Valley? What are we talking about in terms of contamination?
Well, we've got, My study was on basically two types of radiation. The first one I got into was the beta radiation, which is a pretty bad one. It's one that you don't want to get inside you because it can do a lot of damage and cause cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the worst one. Alpha is actually the worst, but beta is one that we can really easily measure. Alpha is not easy to measure. So they had beta measurements, and I was following those, graphing them out until they decided that for some reason they didn't want to show beta anymore. And
When did that happen?
Well, they've been slowly bleeding it off, but it's been chopped in its entirety on the Pacific West Coast. As of this year, as of spring of this year, the last monitors went off.
Hmm.
So we have no more beta to look at. And beta was a good one because it was one of the more sensitive of the radiations that they're analyzing. Any little gamma is a little bit slower to have peaks and valleys. Beta was like right there, right on it. It showed some beautiful daily fluctuations up and down, and the gamma really wasn't showing that until I started looking at the gamma 2 graphs, which were pretty close to following my beta. So now I've transferred over to gamma 2, which is in the 100 to 200 keV range, and includes things like uranium and plutonium.
So what does that mean? What did you say, KeV range? What does that mean?
So that's an energy value that gamma has, and it has a big spectrum of energies depending on the different isotopes. And it goes all the way from 100 all the way up to, golly, I think it's up in the 2000s. And so each isotope, each specific isotope produces different energy levels, different KeV values. So there's groupings in the 100 to 200 range. They call that gamma 2. They have a gamma 3 and a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And each one of those ranges has a spread of values and thus a spread of specific isotopes that are in that those values. And so the EPA wants to know quickly, what isotope are they seeing here when they get something that's spiking a little bit? What could that be? Could that be one of the markers of a fission reaction or a meltdown, mm-hmm. or a burning of a spent fuel pool? So they wanted to have those. So they broke the gamma out that way to really try to pinpoint what's going on quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You can
now,
do that with beta
too. Are all of those
too.
Gamma rays toxic? Are any of them like not so harmful, or are they all just really super toxic?
Well, they're all what you would call ionizing radiation. So they all damage
our DNA,
material.
Our blood cell
material. No, just material. Any kind of material, it will damage. The gamma ray will come out and hit an atom and change it and knock an electron out or do something to it and actually change the physical characteristic of it, whether it's a tree, a person, metal, plastic,
that's
glass.
Why we had the Wigner effect, right?
That's why we have the what?
The Wigner effect.
Yes.
Yeah. It's that. See, that's why we're having all these unknown airplane crashes and weird things happening.
Exactly, and you know the plastics, they really are sensitive to radiation too.
Really.
And oh yeah, I've actually looked into a lot of the different rubbers and plastics and what the problems are, and I'm not surprised from what I'm reading, what I've found that they're having problems with their windshields on the airplanes.
Really? And that is why? Because of the radioactive contamination in the air?
Well, the higher you go, the closer you get to those radioactive fields that are up there too. I mean, they have the Van Allen belts up there, right?
Yeah, you mean the naturally occurring, the one that's there for real, the one that's been there since forever.
Well, they don't know. They don't really know how long it's been there. From what my take on it. In fact, the Russians were back when they first found those things. The Russians were claiming that the U.S. produced them up there from all the atomic testing that we did.
Wow!
And then the U.S. turned around and said and accused the Russians of producing the other one. There's two of them up there. One's a negatively charged one, and one's a positively charged one. So they were playing the fingers back and forth at each other.
What year was this, Matt? When was this?
This is back in the 50s, in the late 50s.
Yeah.
And then the U.S. started having, of course, they started having, you know, they sent up satellites and they started having their little Star Wars issue, and the Russians developed a big laser that they were using to disable some of our satellites, and the U.S. wanted to put a stop to that. So they came up with this plan called Operation Starfish Prime.
Hmm.
And this plan was to detonate a nuclear device high up in the air and load the Van Allen belts with radiation to prevent, to knock out satellites and stuff. And so they shot that thing up. It went off.
They did it?
They did it. They didn't know what they were doing. They had no idea. You know, they just came up with this crazy idea.
They just shot radiation into the atmosphere?
Yeah, so they put the bomb up there. It was like a 50, I think it was like a 50 megaton bomb, pretty good size, way bigger than Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And it really loaded up the Van Allen belts with radiation, way more than they thought. And they figured the stuff would only be there for 2 days. Well, it lasted for years.
Wow.
And it's really hard to find information on exactly how much radiation they put up into the belt during that time, but it knocked out a lot of our satellites. The U.S. satellites and the Russian satellites got fried from that radiation. That was before they had adequate shielding on their satellites.
And wow, that's kind of shocking. I've never heard that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things out there that are really shocking that I've been finding lately, and the more you look, the more you find. So there is a lot of radiation above us that people aren't aware of that's hovering.
So even before Fukushima, we were being bombarded. I mean, not just from the nuclear testing that happened in the 60s, but from them shooting radioactive contamination into the atmosphere intentionally.
Yes.
That's an incredible, that is so, I'm just like, there are not words. So let me just get back to this point. What are these, you know, you're spending all your time on these graphs and figuring it out. Let's just take our little valley here where we're at. What does that mean? What are the contamination levels at? How have they spiked since you've been paying attention? And what does it mean to us in terms of our health and, you know, what we're exposed to? I mean, we hear all the time that people on the West Coast are being bombarded and we're being slammed and we're all going to die. I mean, that's why people don't want to hear about it, because who wants to hear that you're living in a place where you're going to die and there's nothing you can do about it?
Yeah, it's, you know, I guess people have to just start believing in reincarnation in order to get over this really crazy, I wouldn't call it crazy fear. It is a well-founded fear that it is going to affect us, and may not be affecting us quite yet, but because of this issue of latency,
affected us, it just hasn't shown its ugly head yet, right?
Yeah, it hasn't. The latency issue hasn't really come into effect quite yet. We're just at the beginning of it right now. So that depends on what isotope it was that hit you and how much, and how sensitive you are. There's a million different factors. Some people are strong enough that can just laugh it off. And then other people, it just takes just a tiny bit amount, and they're doomed.
Yeah, well,
so it's a game of Russian roulette.
Right.
You know, it's a game
of Russian roulette. Children are affected.
Yes.
Women are affected. We know this. So what are what are the radiation levels like out here? I keep asking you that question, so it's...
Okay, I'm going to talk about Corvallis only right now.
I'm here, man.
Yeah, I'll talk about Corvallis right now, and I'll talk about the beta.
Okay.
Since that's when I had concentrated. So I did. So there's 5 years worth of data that I downloaded. What I pulled off, I pulled off high points, I pulled off low points, I pulled off, and then I calculated averages, and I pulled off all of the hours where they weren't showing me data, and those hours that where they weren't showing me data, I plugged in a value. I guesstimated on what that might be based on the highest reading that they showed me. I figured it would have to be higher than that, so I typically plug that at 1.5 times the highest reading that they showed me, approximately. And that was what I used then to make up my averages. I included those in with the average thing. So in Corvallis, let's see, let's just run down my year averages, and I'll just go from 2011 to 2015. In 11, it was 145 counts per minute. This is an average. 2012, it dropped off to 51. 2013, it bounced back up to 82. And then the last 2 years, 14 and 15, it stayed steady at 71. Hmm. So unfortunately, I don't have any data prior to 2011 to compare. For some reason, the EPA didn't want to give that for this site, but they did give that for two sites in my study, and those being Honolulu and Seattle. They gave out 2010 data, which, to be honest with me, stunned me when I looked at that data, because it was really, really high. And I
in 2010?
Yeah, especially Honolulu, which I can't really, I haven't really come to a conclusion why that is.
Well, so what does that mean? I mean, like, these rates that you're reading to us, are those within range of, like, not causing severe effects, or are they normal by EPA standards, or where are they in terms of what they say the government is telling us is okay?
Well, the government really doesn't tell us anything about being okay, and they don't tell us anything about what the normal readings are at any given site. So what I had to go, so what I, my thing was to go through and look and see what was the 5-year average or the year average here, and then compare that. So in Corvallis, the 5-year average is 84 counts per minute. Mm-hmm. So at 145 in 11, you know, that was almost twice the average. And then it backed off, and then it came back in, and right now it's a little bit under that average, but that average was really skewed by 2011, that high 145 count per minute we had there. So
well, this
my bet
thing.
Is it's...
Also, when we see these ranges coming through, like the radiation goes up and down, once this is my understanding of radioactive isotopes, if correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is once you're contaminated, once it passes through you and you're affected and you've been exposed, there's no unexposing you. It's not like you wash your hands and it goes away. It sticks around. Like, it has fallen on our grass, on our air. I mean, we're dealing with something that the world has never really had to I mean, I guess we have had to deal with it since the 50s, but at such a level that we've never really had such an incomprehensible catastrophe. Am I correct in that?
Well, you're really close. I mean that stuff will radiate us and change us basically for good. Now, some of the isotopes do have half-lives, of course, but once it changes you, there's no going back. So you're correct on that.
And we don't know if we've been changed or not. I mean, there's really no, it just lays in there. We don't know which cell in our, which organ in our, where a cell has been affected. It just sort of sits there in hiding. Like, I know many of our listeners have seen pictures of, say, rice with radioactive isotopes in it, right? We've seen all these pictures coming out of Japan where it's like this little tiny, tiny, tiny black dot on a grain of rice. That one little tiny black dot could, in theory, 15 years from now, cause you to get a severe type of leukemia or cancer.
Yes, yeah. Depending on what it was, yeah. So these isotopes then attack or lodge. They like to lodge in various different parts of the body. You know, strontium likes to go towards the bones, and cesium likes to go towards the muscles. And so if you're starting to see people that have heart attacks out of the blue, well, could be cesium. You know, if you start to see people having leukemia, well, that's a bone disease. That's from bone marrow, and that's pointing towards strontium.
What about tritium? So, what happens with tritium? Because New York City is just off the charts with tritium right now. And many cities around the country, I read a report that said many cities have tritium in its water.
Yeah, it's that's one of the ones where they don't really want to tell you much about. Tritium isn't one that initially was on my radar. That's only come up just recently with everybody, with all these reports of it, you know,
in our water.
But
in our water.
Tritium is,
We're pretty super screwed because there's no getting tritium out of our water. There's nothing they can do. They can filter practically everything else out from what I've read. They cannot filter out tritium, period.
Right, right. It just is there. It's, if you try to evaporate it, it goes up with the evaporation, so it's in the air. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not a good... It's obviously not good. You don't want to be drinking it if you can stay away from it, and you don't want to be breathing anything that's vaporized in the form of a cloud. And unfortunately, you know, there are places where we live that have a lot of fog and a lot of clouds and water you can't live without. So it's probably going to get in everybody at some point, and it's just a matter then of how tough your body is, whether you have your immune system up to a point where you can handle this kind of damage and your body can take those damaged cells and get rid of them and come up with new ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a really hard thing because it's something that we can't really control, right? I mean, that's one of the things, that there's nothing that they don't have any way how to get it out.
Right. And we can't, and it's only going to get worse if they continue to, you know, run these nuclear power plants. It's only going to get worse. And they really should be, they should stop all that insanity, and they should try to concentrate on what they're going to do with the radioactive waste. Like they said 50 years ago when they first started doing this, they said, oh yeah, eventually we'll come up with a plan, but we don't quite have the technology right now. And so they just sort of pushed that aside while they were making all the profits off of nuclear power. And they still haven't figured out a way to do it. And that's got to stop. We have to turn these guys around and say, look at what you're doing, clean that up first, then we can talk about nuclear power. If you can't clean that up, don't bring it back on the table. Don't try to come up with an excuse like global warming to bring this back, because it's not going to happen. You can't substitute one thing that's super bad for another thing that's super bad. That's not going to happen. And we have to really draw that line in the sand for them.
Well, one of the things that I've, you know, read consistently, and I think this is why they're not freaked out, and most of the nuclear scientists are adamant that tritium is not harmful, that by the time we inhale it and ingest it, it doesn't really have any effects.
Yeah. Well, they said that about a lot of the isotopes before they figured out there was a latency thing going on too, right? So who knows what the latency is on the heavy water? I don't really know. I don't think I've read anything on that yet.
Well, I know Dr. Goffman said that there is no safe exposure to these radioactive nuclides, that are man-made nuclides like this that are released through man-made efforts.
Right. Our body has no defense. Yeah, our bodies weren't developed to have that kind of defense, so there is none. And it's the same with everything around us, all the plants and animals around us in our environment. They have no defense about it either. I mean, right now we're seeing some crazy stuff that they're blaming on global warming. And I'm thinking it has a lot more to do with the radiation hit that we took.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This is interesting. You're the first person to bring that up. I'm always stunned that these so-called environmentalist groups, and in fact, I sort of gave up trying to talk to them because the National Resource Defense Fund, Greenpeace, and what was it called? 350.org. Like, I had reached out to them to talk to them about this idea. Why don't you guys? And they adamantly, all three of those organizations, say that they just do not believe that the radioactive contamination is that severe. None of them want to. I mean, we've had 6 years of radioactive contamination from Fukushima at the highest levels we've ever seen, nonstop. There's no way it's not affecting the ocean and causing the warming of the ocean, exacerbating it greatly. There's just no way cannot not be doing that.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues right now. I've been studying a lot of the mutations, a lot of the plant mutations that are in our area here, and it's quite pervasive. I mean, it covers a lot of different plants. The problem with radiation in radiation will come in. It'll hit.
You mean radioactive contamination, like man-made radioactive contamination. Yeah.
Yes, in gaseous form or whatever, will hit. It will damage, and then it'll leave. But it doesn't leave with the damage. The damage is done already, and whatever got hit by it has to then continue to try to live. When you're talking about plants, what radiation does to plants, it decreases the plant's ability to uptake water. And what that does, it mimics drought. It mimics a drought condition. Now, the plant can usually survive for a while, but it is severely compromised. And if then you combine that with a short dry period, then you have a major drought. At least it looks like a major drought because everything's dying off. And why is it dying off? Well, there's a drought going on. Well, you know, there were two things going on with that. The first thing was the radioactive hit, which caused the trees to lose their ability to handle drought. And so that is what I believe is happening right now. And nobody else is talking about it.
I think I'm the only one
with that theory.
I know that Dr. Caldicott talks about this, how tritium, part of what they've discovered is that tritium, a fetus, a baby in utero, a fetus can actually absorb tritium at twice the rates. So that per mass, the fetus is actually much more contaminated than the mother carrying the baby, you know, carrying the fetus at all. And so this is why it's, and there's a huge effort to make people feel like these isotopes are just not that harmful. But I know that Dr. Caldicott's talked about how tritium is extremely deadly. I mean, but there's no getting out of the water. There's no getting it out of anything.
And it's extremely deadly because it gets in the water and we take it inside of us. That's the bad part. You know, it's way worse getting inside us than being on the outside of us. On the outside, when it's floating around, our skin basically will protect us from most of the beta and all of the alpha. And it won't help with the gamma. That'll come shooting right through you. But at least protect you for two of the three different types of radiation. Once it gets in you, all three have the ability to knock us out and can do incredible damage.
This is stunning. So, Matt, how long have you been actually working on accumulating this information? 2011, has this been going on for these last six years?
Yep.
Wow. And you post do you post your information up on any website anywhere?
I am just finishing up my study for No Nukes Northwest, and they have a website called radcast.org, which I will be putting all my graphs on that in the near future.
Well, I know at No Nukes Northwest we're working on getting a website built in the next month. That's going to be something. So we're going to have a specific website for No Nukes Northwest. So
okay, so maybe it's going to be going on that then too.
Hopefully, I haven't heard that. So right now it's on Radcast.
It's not on Radcast yet, but that was the plan that I had.
Okay. Well, this is the thing, because this is important information to understand about, especially on the West Coast. There's a lot of anxiety about us being slammed and hammered, and people tell us, you know, you're being exposed. But frankly, isn't the whole, I mean, that's one of the things that Chuck Heinemann discusses. He's in Kansas, in the heart of the country. And if you just took a quick perusal look at the EPA website, compare it to the West Coast and the East Coast, in some instances, the radiation looks like it's far higher in the Midwest.
Yeah, and I believe that. You know, at first I didn't understand why, but now after looking at, after understanding the way the Earth operates, you know, the way the wind patterns operate, the way we have these Hadley cells and the Farrell cells and the polar cells and the jet streams that travel in between these cells, and knowing the which way the prevailing winds go from summer to winter.
Will you come back and explain some of that with us, because you're saying
I can. It's very complicated, and it took me a while to figure it out. But yeah, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, I'd really love to for you to come back and have that explained to us, because these are things that just, unfortunately, as regular citizens, we, like you, you're a citizen scientist. We have to know this information in order to protect our families and ourselves.
Yes, yes.
Now, is this affecting, you think, the Southern Hemisphere? Is it mostly just the Western Hemisphere? Do you think it has gone around the planet?
Totally. There's no escape.
Really?
Absolutely no escape.
There's no keeping it up in the Western Hemisphere because of the air currents and the air winds and things like that?
Well, they were hoping it would all stay in the Northern Hemisphere because we have that Hadley cell effect down at the equator. But all of these cells that circulate around, they transfer into the adjacent cells. They're just not a thing on itself. There's a boundary layer where they bump up against each other and they transfer stuff back and forth. So yeah, it has been transferred now to a lesser degree, I'll say, into the Southern Hemisphere, but it's still being anything that's out there will get, if it's a higher concentration here and lower there, it will be transferred over into the lower concentration area.
Mm-hmm.
in time. Yep.
That is stunning.
And from my grasp, I see some of the worst radiation up in Alaska.
Well, that makes sense, don't you think? I mean, considering that the jet stream goes right from Japan right to Alaska.
Well, it actually sort of circles just below Alaska, but there's a polar cell up there that dominates, but everything that went out of Fukushima by the feral cell gets pushed northward, and by the trades gets pushed westward. And so there's a northwest trajectory, basically, on all the particles that go up, and then when it hits that boundary cell, they get transferred over. And I'm still looking at why it looks like they got hit so hard. Maybe it had something to do with our magnetosphere. Mm-hmm. In the world.
Is there are there radioactive contamination limits higher still to this day, or did it just happen when Fukushima happened?
It from what I'm seeing, it basically happened when Fukushima happened, and it's gotten progressively worse. Worse. There's some really strange things coming up on my graph. One of the things is what I call a Venetian blind effect, where we're having huge spikes, and the spikes are usually so huge that they won't show them. So we're having, every day they have swaths of hours or an hour or two or three where they don't show the data every single day. And when you start graphing that, it looks like a Venetian blind.
Why do you think they don't show the graphs every single day? What's going on? I mean, do you notice an increase, a spike, and then they turn it off, or what happens?
Yeah, typically that's what you see. You'll see a slight increase, or like something is happening, it'll turn off. When it comes back on, you'll see a slight decrease coming back down to the levels that they were. Sometimes they're higher levels, sometimes they're lower levels. You never know.
Do you think that the people in Alaska are safe? Do you think that people... I mean, I have clients in Alaska who I've attempted to broach a subject, and they're like, oh, no, we're all perfectly fine up here. We're okay. I mean...
Yeah, I just...
Not so much,
you know, from the graphs I'm seeing, I just...
What about these Native American tribes that are still continuing to eat the salmon, the fish? They live off the land. They hunt the animals. They eat all the animals off of there. I mean, those animals must be much more radioactively contaminated than, say, killing a deer in Michigan, for example, or, you know, somewhere like that.
There are certain animals, of course, that like to thrive on plants that like to absorb radiation, right? I mean, you've heard about the reindeer culls up in Sweden when Chernobyl blew, and the reindeer became so highly radioactive they had to kill off huge herds of them because they are eating the lichen and the moss.
Wow.
Those two things love radionuclides, and they love to grow. And if you look around the Pacific Northwest, especially in our area here, and you go out and you look for moss and lichen and stuff like that, you'll see that, holy crap, it's everywhere. In fact, it's been growing. It's been growing on surfaces that it shouldn't grow on.
That's what Chuck Hyman says. He says, look, radioactivity and moss and mold go together. That's why we see an increase in moss and mold around the planet. If you look at Chernobyl, he says, it's full of mold, full of lichen and things that had never really grown there before because it grows with the radiation. The radiation attaches to it. That's why I have him on regularly. He's going to be coming on in the next couple of weeks, but we talk about you can buy microbes. He sells a product with these microbes that have mega microbes in it. You dump it on your, on a regular basis, like every quarter or every three, once a month or every quarter, depending on the size of your land. Dump your microbes on the land. It actually absorbs the radioactive contamination and regenerates the land to keep up with the bombardment of radiation from the rain. So it's that whole thing is very interesting about how the mold is growing everywhere. We've noticed it here in the Northwest.
Oh yeah. I mean, if you go out and you look at, you don't have any problem collecting huge swaths of lichen that fall from the trees now. And in fact, in my yard, in my backyard, I've never seen this. I've been there since 2004, and the grass used to always be just grass, and now it's just littered with lichen that's falling off of the fir trees, just littered. And you look down the streets, and it's all over the place. And you look down, if there's any water flowing down in the gutters, sometimes it's just fully green with algae. Algae's another one that likes to they use the nuclear radiation actually as food. Those plants consider that a food source. They don't know any difference. And I've also seen trees, especially the Doug firs here in Oregon, which is a major tree for the timber industry. I saw those get incredibly hurt by the radiation of Fukushima, where it actually mutated the trees that year into producing some very strange shapes. Two in particular that I found that I've cataloged and researched on. One of them I call a 60-40 split, and the other one I call a shark bite. And maybe in another interview we can go over those things and I can talk to you about what I found there, because those were physical markers of what happened. And you can go out to the trees and look at the Doug firs of a certain age and go, see that spot right there? That's 2011. You can see it in all these trees right here.
I have two Doug firs in front of my home, and
are they small?
No, they're gigantic. They are gigantic.
Yeah, the bigger ones are hard to see that in. It's really tough. But the smaller ones, the ones that were maybe 10 years old at the time, so they'd be a 20-year-old tree now, should have a lot of, they'll have basically 20% of the trees that I saw had those kind of variations.
Well, the one thing we have noticed, and my landlord was commenting to me about this, the tops of the trees look sick, not the bottom.
Yeah, they're...
The tops, like the trees. In fact, you'll drive through the Oregon coast and you'll see this beautiful side, and you'll see patches of just the top quarter of a tree completely brown and orange. The rest of it's green. The very tippy top of it is brown.
Yeah.
And they can't figure, experts can't figure that one out. They don't know why.
Plants are strange in that it seems to me that every branch is like a thing of its own. Almost every leaf too, because you can find mutations in leaves, for instance, that don't cover the whole tree. There might be a single branch that has a lot of them on it, and so trees, you can cut off a branch, it still lives. So I think the damage that's happening is specific to the tops of the trees, and I see a lot of that damage here in Corvallis too. You go around, look, it's it's pervasive. And I don't think, I'm hoping that it's that it doesn't mean the tree is actually going to die, that it's just a, you know, that it's just a, it's just been wounded, and it will, you know, as long as the lower branches are still green, there's still hope. But mm-hmm. I think it has to do with that, with its ability to uptake water, and it can't get water now up to the top of the tree, and that's why it's dying off. That's why the tops are dying.
That makes sense. That actually does make sense, because there's something, there is a, that inability to absorb water. Well, look, we have just a few minutes left, Matt, and I really want to discuss briefly with you this idea of, here we are living, again, I keep coming back to this idea, we're living on the West Coast, we're being bombarded. Yep. You're following the radioactive contamination rates on the West Coast. Obviously, much, much higher than it was 10 years ago, right? How do people cope with this? I mean, what do we do with this information? I mean, is there anything that you've discovered that we can do to protect ourselves? Anything that keeps us safer? I know that comes completely out of left field. You're not an expert, but is there anything in your research that you have found?
I think one of the keys would be try to keep the body's immune system as healthy as possible. Because if there's any crack in that, if there's any crack in that immune system, the radiation will find it, and it'll use it to its to your demise. So you have to keep your body healthy. You have to keep taking as healthy things as you can. And it's hard to do when radioactive is now spread throughout everything. You know,
right.
one of my biggest issues was that all of a sudden our organic produce is not. It's not. It might not be healthy for us anymore, and that was driving me insane.
Yeah.
That now they've poisoned,
even
you know, our
organic,
last good
yeah.
source of food. You know, now what do we do? How do we make a non radionuclide food? We'd have to grow it inside greenhouses now, right?
Well, as Chuck would say, microbes, microbes, microbes. Keep bombarding organic food with microbes. I mean, that is really, and in fact, Charlotte Anthony from Victory Gardens for All out here, she's a permaculturist that I've been talking to get her. And we keep doing the interview. She keeps saying, well, I want to make it a better interview. So eventually we're going to get her on the air because we keep pre-recording it. But she says that the microbes, and she agrees completely with Chuck, microbes really are the answer. If we can really get enough microbes into the land, we can at least offset the continual bombardment of it. But it has to be a continual, regular basis of it. It can't just be you put it on your land one time. You have to continue to do it. It has to be a multi-billion-dollar industry, frankly, where we just do it naturally without even thinking.
Right.
So, but that is an answer. That's a really viable answer that will work. So, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'll have to think about that.
Yeah, me too. Well, I'm actually getting microbes. I mean, I have some microbes that I'm going to put on my garden. And here in the Northwest, we do a lot of gardening. That's kind of a normal. I mean, I came from California, and that was pretty much the first thing you got was you got to learn how to garden. So, I feel lucky in that regard because at least I can control some of my food supply. So, look, Matt, we have just less than 30 seconds left. So I want to thank you for joining us. And I am looking forward to our next visit in a week. Or I think we've scheduled you for 2 weeks so we could get more of this information out. Truly appreciate the information. Shortly, we'll be able to find your work on Radcast. And I just want to thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay.
Lonnie, anytime.
Well,
okay.
Put your courage feet on, you guys. Let's take some action. There's things that we can do. Education is the way out. And we'll talk with you guys later.